He muttered an extra prayer for the hundreds already in the square below, to be joined by thousands more in the coming hours. Oh, that this would be more than mere spectacle, the last of the blood sports, sanctioned by the faith and financed by the keep. Oh, that they would see heaven's justice and be drawn into repentance, that the potter might mold their hearts to see the thinness of this life compared to the immensity of the next. Oh, that they would believe. What is up, you guys? Welcome back to another episode. It is finally here. We are starting Act 3, the home stretch of this story. Where we left things off, Hatham is in prison. The spider has struck a deal to secure peace among the brethren. Lee is on the outs, and Elias is sitting secure in his victory. If you forgot where we are during the hiatus, don't worry. I will have a link to the full playlist down in the episode description, along with several recap videos that you can use just to give you a sense of where we are. All right, that is enough. Enough out of me. I will catch you guys at the end of the episode. I'm Josh Call, and this is Last Colosseum. The first thing the old man remembered was a sense of vague disappointment, sour on his tongue, when his dream turned out to be just that. The second thing, all too familiar, for he counted himself lucky when it woke him fewer than four times a night, was the terrible pressure on his bladder like an overfull wineskin. With the controlled urgency of a man who had pissed himself more than once, the old man slipped his calcified feet into the doe-skin slippers at the edge of his bed and creaked to his feet. He was a man of routine. He didn't open his eyes until he had crossed the room, grasped the handle to the privy without groping, and shuffled in to do his necessaries. Time had gradually stolen the pleasure of sleep, worn it away over years like a steady drip through a stone. Besides the many interruptions to squirt an unseen trickle into the pot, these days sleep was shallow and short, and he was always up before the sun. He hung his nightgown on the hook by the door after shaking himself dry, then scraped sparks onto the candle by the washbasin. The flickering circle of orange light bloomed to life. A sheen of sweat gleamed on the dome of his belly, dark shadows quavering in the folds of his sagging jowls. He lathered his face with the brush beside the candle and set about scraping smooth his chins. He could have had one of the boys shave him. They'd have done a better job of it, for the old man's shaking hands as often nicked him as not, but he'd never really considered it. Just as it had when he was 15 in the monastery, it gave the old man great pleasure to do his own shaving. And if any of the brothers noticed the little cuts on his jaw while he was overseeing the mass, no one had ever said anything. He hardly remembered rinsing his face and stowing the razor in its case, for he clung to the tattered edges of his dream by his fingertips until he could no longer. He was a boy again, smooth and unlined, his arms strong and back straight. Before his vows, the brothers had put him to task in the kitchens, chopping onions and strangling chickens for the pot. It was there, he recalled, as his eyes opened and his gaze flicked down to the bulge of his gut, that he had discovered his second abiding love, one which all the piety and asceticism of the faith hadn't been able to snuff out. For it was there that he'd first discovered food. His stomach rumbled as he shuffled back into the bedchamber and slipped into his vestment. Not the ornate one with the gold trim that his attendant had laid out for him in the night, but a simple dress of white homespun of the same kind that the rest of the brothers wore. He preferred not to wear the fancy cassock if he could avoid it. The heavy trim and the enormous gold medallion, not to mention the stiff leather girdle he wore to bear up under its weight, made it a labor to wear, even for an hour. He'd slip into it before the ceremony, no doubt helped by one of the boys to tighten all the laces, and be back in his usual habit at the first available opportunity. The old man knelt gingerly on a small silk cushion before the window in his doe-skin slippers as the first intimation of daylight bled through the glass, and he addressed his prayers to each of the fourfold faces, king and potter, slave and judge. A low rumble of conversation met him through the window, as if Cirrus had for a moment peeled back the veil and bent the old man's ear to the 10,000 pre-dawn prayers rising toward heaven from all corners of the city. But of course it wasn't that. That rumble of street chatter had been constant over the past few days, ever since the gallows went up. It started small, but every day more and more arrived with their bedrolls and sacks of victuals to stake out a good spot to watch, until the sound through the glass was like an ever-present roll of thunder no matter the hour. The keepers had tried to enforce a strict no-fires policy in the square. If an errant spark caught one of the canvas awnings above the shop fronts or the banners hanging from the balconies that ringed the square, the whole district might burn. But the low folk paid them no mind, and when the old man would wake in the small hours for his fourth piss, his bedchamber was bathed with flickering orange from the torchbug lights of a dozen small fires. He didn't mind. The low folk were coming in from as far as Larkspur and Erling and the tiny nameless hamlets beyond. An execution might be the nearest many of them ever came to the mass. And given the sheer spectacle of a hanging, the renown of the man condemned, and the lurid nature of his crimes, which had been breathlessly talked about during his trial, even by some of the younger brothers, the old man fully expected the square to be packed to the balconies by noonday. He muttered an extra prayer for the hundreds already in the square below, to be joined by thousands more in the coming hours. Oh, that this would be more than mere spectacle, the last of the blood sports, sanctioned by the faith and financed by the keep. Oh, that they would see heaven's justice and be drawn into repentance, that the potter might mold their hearts to see the thinness of this life compared to the immensity of the next. Oh, that they would believe. It was a while before he could bring himself to stand. The last thing he did before he started down the stairs was to open his desk drawer and withdraw a tiny cloth-wrapped bundle bound with twine. Inside was a lump of chocolate, dark and jagged, small enough to cup in one hand. It pained the old man to see how thin his supply had become. The dark ambrosia was a rarity in this corner of the world. And with great care and deliberation, he shaved off a translucent curl of sweetness and popped it into his mouth. The archpriest sat at the desk for almost as long as he'd been kneeling, his eyes closed, savoring the taste. He heard the swish of slippered feet on the stairs below as he descended, and Father Vesely appeared from around the bend, his pinched and blotchy features looking even more pinched and blotchy in the light from the candle he held trembling on its little saucer. "You should really carry a light with you, Your Eminence," murmured the junior priest, pressing against the wall to allow the old man to shuffle past. "It would be a terrible loss to the soul of the city if anything were to happen to you." The archpriest ignored the comment. 19 years he'd gone up and down these steps in relative darkness, one hand curled around the railing bolted to the wall. If heaven decided to take him by way of a fall down the stairs in his 78th year, that was heaven's prerogative.
"Is everything ready?"
"Assignments have been given. One service at vespers and another at midnight, and 4 more tomorrow."
"I asked for 6.
The sanctuary was never so full, not for funerals, not for holy days, not for the solstice mass, as it was on the day following an execution. Let 1,000 men be hanged and quartered on the steps if it meant the rest came home. He could guess at Vesely's expression as he trailed the old man down the stairs.
"We don't have enough, with the extra hands you requested at each."
The old man's shadow danced on the stairs below him as the junior priest's candle hand shook.
"I'll reshuffle the assignments," Vesely said after a moment.
The archpriest nodded.
"And the condemned man? Has he repented?"
The other man didn't reply.
"Vesely..."
"The warden isn't permitting visitors."
"The warden has no business preventing..."
"He bit 2 fingers off of one of the jailers."
That caught him by surprise.
"Very good."
They had reached the refectory. Vesely snuffed his candle and stowed it in the folds of his robe. The 2 long tables that ran the length of the room were about half full, and at the archpriest's entrance, the burble of conversation lulled as the brothers and novices dipped their heads respectfully to the old man. He glanced back at Father Vesely and dropped his voice by half.
"Send 2 of the brothers to give him rites before they start him down the path," he murmured.
Cirrus had as much charged them with the care of the condemned man's soul as anyone else's. The junior priest nodded and scuttled off to do as he'd been bidden. The old man sighed and found his usual seat at the end of one of the benches, taking the arm of one of the novices with a murmured thank you when it was offered. The whole business had put a sour feeling in his gut. Perhaps it was that in recent moons he'd been rather removed from the typical day-to-day in the sole care of the city, entrusting it to Vesely and the other fathers while he tended to the governor and his circle. Lady Femeriel's illness had taken a bad turn in the past year, and most days the archpriest was up in the keep at the governor's side, leading him in prayers to the potter for her return to health, or to the king for his mercy. Perhaps it was that the whole affair had a rather spectacular quality to it. The old man couldn't shake the feeling that he and the other brothers were unwitting actors in some kind of grand mummer's play. Perhaps it was only indigestion, or the ulcer that age and worry and the governor's recent troubles had put low in his belly. He gratefully accepted the bowl of oat porridge when it was passed to him, same for the archpriest as for the novices. Of course, Friar Cole was always sure to add 3 drops of truffle oil to the old man's bowl. He dipped his head with the others as one of the junior priests blessed the meal. He ate slowly and methodically, savoring the truffle taste. Before he was half finished, most of the others had eaten and left to do as they wished in the few minutes before morning prayers. This slowed him down all the more, for he had to continually pause to return a gesture of benediction as each of the brothers hailed the archpriest on his way past. He was quite the sight, his cheeks packed with porridge, a sheen of truffle oil on his chin, and the old man was grateful as the refectory emptied and he was able to finish his meal in relative peace. There was still a knot of pimple-faced novices nattering at the other end of the long table. The old man hadn't been trying to eavesdrop, but their conversation broke in on his thoughts, and he caught himself watching the lads out of the corner of his eye.
"Come on, you've got to tell," one of the boys was urging the other. "So you can blab about it and get us all put on cobweb duty,"
his mate shot back.
"I will not. I found the spot days ago. Find your own." "You don't actually think Grizzle is going to let you watch, do you?"
interjected a third.
"He's going to have every one of us scrubbing floors in the sanctuary for Vespers. Grizzle doesn't need to know what he doesn't know. He's going to be hiding in the belfry watching it himself."
The others snickered, and the speaker, who looked to be the oldest at about 16, flushed with pride.
"Have you heard what they're saying about him out in the square?"
one of the others murmured after their laughter had faded.
"About Grizzle?"
More laughter.
"No, you ass. About him, the Reaper."
The archpriest had stopped eating altogether. He sat listening with his hands neatly folded. The boy dropped his voice a fraction.
"Story is, he's been dead for a 7 year. Doesn't matter what they try, he just gets up and keeps coming." "Well, I know who that sounds like,"
grinned the eldest, fingering his wooden medallion. The old man felt a twist in his gut at the boy's irreverence, and with his eyes on the dollop of porridge at the bottom of his bowl, he murmured,
"Careful, boys. Never can tell who might be listening."
Immediately, all 4 were on their feet, their faces scarlet. The one who had made the profane comment dropped to a knee.
"Your Eminence."
His gaze was on the floor.
"We weren't. I was just having a laugh."
The archpriest waved him off and slowly eased himself off the bench. One of the boys looked as if he'd try to help the old man to his feet, but he caught himself and instead stared at a crack in the floor, his hands clasped in front of him. The old man motioned for the ringleader to stand with the rest of them.
"Do you know why the church oversees executions throughout Dominion?"
None of them spoke.
"It's because God, and only God, holds the power of life and death."
"Yes, Your Eminence,"
one of the boys agreed, his voice half a whisper.
"And do you know why she administers them publicly before the whole city?"
He motioned with his gloved hand to the doors at the end of the refectory, beyond which lay the sanctuary and still farther the square. Again, no one spoke.
"It's an act of purgation. Do you know what that means? Cleansing. For the condemned and for the city. It's a moment where the veil of heaven is drawn back and the judgment of God stands alone, cold and stark and absolute. And it is against that blinding white that his church stands, holding grace in both hands. That is our charge. And yours, once you take your vows.
The boys nodded. The ringleader's lower lip quivered as if he might cry. The archpriest looked at each of them in turn before he spoke again.
I'd like the four of you to stand by during the ceremony, he said. If Father Griswold says anything, tell him that I've given you a special assignment. I'd like you to follow and pray, for the condemned and for the people. And when you look at him, I'd like you to remember, but for grace, it's my neck in that noose.
He nodded toward the doors in the back.
Now get on. You'll miss prayers.
The novices thanked him, bowing low as they retreated toward the stairs. The old man sighed, gathering up his bowl and spoon to return them to the kitchens. He didn't begrudge them the laugh. The boys were a product of the strange and irreverent time they all occupied. Novices kept coming to the church older and older to begin their studies, increasingly bogged down by the lead weight of world lust. It unsettled him to think on what Cyrus would say as the hour drew near for the old man to stand before him. Had they, the archpriest, the bishops, and the rest, forsaken their solemn duty to raise up the next generation of the faithful? He thought not. They'd certainly tried. But was it their fault? His fault, most especially, if the next generation refused to be bridled? The echo of 20 male voices was haunting and lovely as the old man made his way down the low stone passage into the sanctuary. The sound was a comfort to him. The high speech had always been like a warm blanket, ever since his first assignment trimming votives when he was 7 or 8. So many 7-year hadn't changed the music, nor dulled the prickle on his nape and the warm flush in his chest when he heard it. He let his hand trail across the backs of the pews, drinking in the multicolored motes of light that cut the high vaulted chamber into slivers. As the morning prayers lapsed into silence, he heard the swelling thunder of the square through the big doors at the end of the nave. Through the window, he could just make out the ominous crook in the long arm of the gallows. He didn't like it. The sanctuary ought to have been open to all, but since the scaffold went up, the keepers had assigned a patrol day and night to guard the steps to ensure that no one climbed on the device, play-acting the hanged man with their heads in the noose. Even as the crowd had swelled outside yesterday, attendance for the mass had been woefully low. The archpriest's brow was creased with thought, his heart heavy and shoulders stooped with the weight of 500,000 souls under his care at the edge and beyond. Even 6 services packed to the rafters, and 2 more this evening, were only a fraction of all those who would be there to watch the drop, who are out there even now. Was it all just spectacle to them, like a grisly sort of mummer's play? He hoped not. The hope sat sour and uneasy in his gut, but perhaps that was the ulcer. A glint near the foot of one of the pews caught his eye and dashed his thoughts to pieces. He bent down to fish it out from under the pew, fearing that his knees would stick that way. It was a crown. The old man's reflections shone ragged over the carved image of the citadel at Nexus, her perfect white tower stretching almost to heaven. He'd been there a handful of times in his life, and never not once as he'd first glimpsed her above the still green waters of Lake Mercy, or as the God's Road rounded that last sharp northward bend, had she failed to take his breath away. But he was not thinking of Nexus, nor of the slave on the tree stamped on the reverse side of the coin, nor even, for a moment anyway, of the execution that was fast approaching. He was thinking of chocolate. Rare though it was on the outer edge of Dominion, Friar Call had his ways, and for a crown the ruddy little cook could get his flour-stained hands on 50 pounds of the good stuff. The archpriest disappeared the gold piece into the folds of his habit as he was standing. If he'd caught one of the novices in such a compromising position, they'd have been lucky to get off with a stern talking to about plundering the purse of heaven. And that was the least of it. If Father Griswold were the one to catch him, the hard-eyed taskmaster would have laid a switch across the boy's bare buttocks. But any thoughts such as these only barely pricked the old man's conscience and were easily attributed to indigestion or his worries about the coming execution. They had long since faded by the time he returned to his rooms to change into his gold-fringed cassock. After all, if the judge damned hypocrites, who would sit the pews in heaven? Thank you guys so much for listening. I am super relieved to be starting the last act of this story. And before you get upset that it'll be ending soon, don't worry, there is still a whole lot of story to go. As always, it is a huge favor if you leave a like or a comment on the video, or if you're catching this on Spotify and you leave a 5-star review, that lets this story reach as many people as possible. All right, that's enough out of me. It is good to be back. I'll see you guys next week.